From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Today, as part of our Resilient Youth series in partnership with the Live Like Sam organization, we're speaking with trauma therapist and parenting expert, Maggie Nick. Nick's new book is called Good Kids, Why You Suffered in Silence and How to Break the Cycle. She'll delve into the anxieties and fears that are often present within the kids we usually don't worry about. You know, the easy kids who grow up believing that they must always be dependable, responsible, achieving and pleasing, even to their own detriment. She'll discuss new, more informed approaches parents can use that could break this high-pressure cycle for both adults and kids. We'll be back after these words. Stay with us. This is The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. What if being the good kid wasn't the gift everyone thought it was? Our guest today is trauma therapist and parenting expert Maggie Nick, author of Good Kids, Why You Suffered in Silence and How to Break the Cycle. In Good Kids, she unpacks the hidden cost of being praised as easy, mature, and so well-behaved.
She also explores why so many of those children grow into adults battling perfectionism, people-pleasing, and a fear of failure. Maggie reveals how well-meaning parenting can unintentionally create shame-based patterns. And she offers research-backed tools to break the cycle and raise emotionally healthy, self-assured kids. Maggie Nick, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. Hi.
Well, hi. This is... wow, a big topic and probably one that not a lot of parents think about, because after all, we aspire to raise a good kid and a well-behaved kid and all of those things. But I think also today as parents, we also say we want to raise a happy kid, which feels better to me. Why don't you set the stage for what you're talking about here and how this comes up against how we unintentionally parent in the way that we think feels best.
I mean, it's so complicated, right? Like, I do think that there were, when we zoom out, and I talked about this in the book, I really try to get a sense of how did our parents come to parent this way? And the answer is they were parented this way and all the way up. It's adjusted a little bit. We moved away from punitive discipline using our hands to more of a shame-based model in our childhoods. So I think there were efforts to try to protect kids. We just didn't realize that we swapped one weapon for another, and shame is poison and there's no safe dose of poison, unfortunately, which is why we're all struggling. But I do think that there have been these misguided expectations that have just been handed down and gone unchecked for the most part. And so I truly do not believe that our parents had any idea that it would end up like this. I don't. I believe that they thought their job was to pull up their sleeves. I don't enjoy this any more than you do, but my job, the way I'm a good parent, is to raise you to be respectful and successful. Right. And I just have to punish you basically until you stop fighting back. And then you're a good kid, nose boop. And I'm a good parent, nose boop. And everybody, it's wild how we really didn't know. I think the first, I need to fact check this because I keep quoting this but it's in a point worth making that I'm the first book ever published that presented the idea that children had emotional needs was in the 50s. Right? It wasn't even a thing to think about children having emotional needs. I think our parents thought our emotional needs included being told, I love you. But that was kind of shaky. Sometimes it felt like we had to earn that back, and I'm proud of you, which again, something we had to earn that could be revoked. Right. And so we are all kind of collectively going to therapy, or we're on social media and we're getting exposed to these things that talk about healthy relationships and how people apologize when you're owed an apology. And it's important for you to learn how to take accountability. And we're all going, what? How do you, what? And then we have a healthy relationship and it changes us. Like, this is relational trauma and it's healed in relationships. So we'll have a relationship. For me, it was my therapist, actually. And like, I had this person that saw me, that didn't judge me, that didn't make me feel like I was disgusting for talking about things that I felt ashamed of. And it changes you. And so then we're kind of going to our other relationships and we're like, can it be like this with you? And I think that's really like where we're seeing a lot of this, like, with older, you know, grown adults that are trying to reconcile this with their parents, and their parents saying, you should just be grateful. We did the best we could. You know, it's hard. But like, there is a really long-term trajectory here that we are laying the groundwork for. Sorry, yeah. I got way off topic, but I hope I answered that question.
That's okay. Well, you know, how about we just state right up front, it's a given. We are all doing the best that we can. Our parents did the best that they could. We're doing the best we can. As they say, you don't get a manual on how to parent. You do what feels best. And this has made me, I just want to give you this instance in which my parents would take me and my three siblings out to dinner very occasionally, because back then you just didn't go out that much, right? And inevitably, they would say to us at the end of the dinner how someone came up to them and said, oh my, you have the most well-behaved kids. And there would be this sense of pride that, you know, my parents would exude, and then I would feel proud. And then, you know, I would, now that I'm an adult, I kind of can look at that and say, wow, that was about feeding my parents' ego as parents. And that's so much what we need. But I would also say that there was something in that instance that made me want to behave well. And so I think a lot of parents are, you know, and children are going to say, is that bad?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we tend to see that as a huge success as the parent, right? Like when our kids are, especially in public, right? Like there's some messed up things about, you know, your job is to make me look good and make me proud, and they don't feel so great, but I get it. And I'm a parent and it's wonderful. And we're out in the public and my kids are well-behaved. That's the best, right? The issue, I think, and like the thing that I would speak to is that it is not normal for children to never misbehave. Like that is the child, like if when parents call me because they want to get their kids in to see me for counseling, and there's often been a divorce or a death in the family or some sort of traumatic car accident, something, and they're really worried about the bad kid, air quotes for everybody. They're not bad, but the difficult kid, right? Who's skipping school or refusing to do work or being openly disrespectful, really struggling. Most of those parents bring the child in, like fix them. Right? They're not seeing that as a child who's struggling. And like, that's a big nuance that I think this generation of parents who are parenting now and kind of the one right before us were sort of, oh, when they're like that, they're not okay. I still don't know what to do. I still have no new tools, but I'm starting to realize they're not okay. When I have those parents call, I'm like, that child does need and deserve support. That child is struggling and you can see it. I'm actually more concerned and wanting to know if there's a child in the home that seems just fine, who seems unimpacted, because that's actually the child I worry about the most, because that child is pushing everything down. Like the child who's openly struggling is at least releasing stress from their body. The other child is white knuckling and like barely, it's like when we're holding our feelings down, Gabor Mate talks about it as like trying to hold beach balls underwater. Like it takes a lot of energy to hold beach balls underwater. It takes a lot of work to keep it together on the outside when inside you're not okay. And so it's really about accidentally and unintentionally, that's such an important part of this, because I truly don't believe that our parents had any idea that coming at the moments where we struggled on the outside, right? With like, what is wrong with you? You know better. You should be ashamed of yourself. I'm not mad. I'm just disappointed. And then the one that cuts me the deepest, like I expected more from you. Oh, sorry guys. But like, the problem is when you're the child, you don't just learn, oh, I shouldn't do that. You learn there's something wrong with the version of me that did that. It's like our parents saw us in a bad way. Like when in these moments where we were disorganized, let's say, or tired, but they called it lazy. It's like, I've seen who you really are. I can't trust who you really are. Like, I better never see that side of you again. Like, it's not so much, it's partly the expectations that a child, that it's our job to punish them into being well-behaved and they should never misbehave ever again. That's insane. Like, full stop. The literature, we have mountains of literature that is completely incorrect. But it's also about when they do misbehave, being able to see through that misbehavior to a struggling, overwhelmed child inside who needs, like, as parents, we need to hold our no matter what happens next. Like, the boundaries are not optional and we don't need less of them. And we don't need kinder necessarily. Like, we don't need permissive parenting. I'm not all about that. But we need to hold the boundary, but not punish the child for struggling with it. There are very specific reasons why when children push back. And it always makes sense when we can, like, look at it from that framework.
Sure. We're talking with author Maggie Nick, who has a new book out called Good Kids, Why You Suffered in Silence and How to Break the Cycle. Maggie, if listeners are just joining us, can you share a little bit about what the dynamic of a good kid is? What maybe, or what are the tendencies or the feelings of a good kid, whether they're a kid now or an adult who grew up as a good kid in their family?
Yes. And in the book, I talk through in the third part, which is the how to parent a good kid. The first two are kind of how to heal yourself if you were this child. And then the third one is parenting. I talk through 10 good kid check engine lights. I call them check engine lights. Just that's how I see it as a therapist. So those are kind of the things I scan for in kids and the things that, you know, make me worried. And I tried the best I could to give you a handbook, actually, of like what it looks like, the deeper struggles, the words they need to hear, helping you get to a place where you can like say those words and mean it. And then maybe if that's you, how to tend to your inner child. But the good kid is the one who is the delight to have in class. So mature, so responsible, such an old soul, basically so mature and responsible and disciplined that you feel like you don't even need to discipline them. Like they parent themselves. What I really want the world to know is that what looks like success and crushing life on the outside often hides a lot of anxiety and feeling really bad about yourself on the inside. Good kids tend to really like, and we see it in childhood and adulthood. I mean, it looks a little bit different, school versus work, but never feeling like you can relax or fully let your guard down. You know, like sitting down and trying to sit on the couch actually makes you more anxious, not less. Being extremely hard on yourself, not being able to enjoy a win because you're already picking it apart, thinking what you should have done better and moving the goalposts. Like, well, this was good. 98 is good, but I could do better. And like, I have to punish myself into doing better. Feeling anxious and on edge and like you're constantly in trouble or like, you know, the extreme fear of somebody being mad at you, like literally feeling like life or death. When we have a parent who dominates a child into submission and calls it respect, sorry, I know that's a hammer, but that's what it is. Like our parents thought they needed to teach us to be respectful by basically dominating us into submission to them. Like that is going to shut down that child's ability to like regulate emotion, release feelings. Like they're going to do exactly what you're telling them, but there's going to be a huge cost. And that's what the book's about.
Yeah. So I was a textbook good kid, oldest of six, and Catholic, and there was just a lot of pressure on me. And I realized as a young adult that I never felt like I had been allowed to be mad about anything, that my job was to be a peacemaker and a harmonizer and a helper and, you know, and that pleasure to have in class. And so that led to a profound difficulty for me with conflict that is still problematic as an adult and a partner and a parent. Is conflict a common issue for grown-up good kids?
Oh my gosh, yes. Like literally trying to say, hey, that hurt me, feels like your life is in danger. Like it has
does.
To do
your
with
heart is beating.
Oh,
and
like there's horrible. A bear after you. Like, I mean, it sounds silly, but like that is how our nervous system works. A threat is a threat. And like in this case, someone being mad at you is a relational threat, right? And like, I have a very, very viral video that I know it's hard to hear, but I do think it's important. And I'm like, I'm going to hold your hand while I say this, but like the reason you're so terrified of people being mad at you is because you've probably never felt what it feels like for somebody to be mad at you and also make you feel like they love you. Like, I think the reason we have actual, like, not just fear, not just anxiety, but like terror over the idea of somebody being mad is because it feels like that goes, like, that naturally goes with the, they don't love me anymore. The relationship's over. Right? Because I think, again, this is one of the things that I try to do as a parent, what I try to teach in the book is like, I can say, you know, I am not like, I teach stand by them is one of the five adjustments. I talk through like five, just little, we don't need to like change everything. We just need these little adjustments away from dousing everything with shame. So it's, I don't stand by what you did, right? I don't agree with the choices you made. You're going to have to show up for the consequences of your actions. You're going to have to make this right. But I will always stand by you. Like, that's the way we raise kids who aren't terrified and in a chokehold at the idea of somebody being mad at them. We show them we can be mad at each other and still love each other. I will stand by you. We will do that. We will face the consequences of your actions together. I will be next to you. I'm not going to send you away. I'm not going to ice you out and make you feel like you don't matter to me. Like, I might need a minute. I'm kind of mad. I'm going to go in the other room, but I love you and I will not leave you. Like, I think the silent treatment has a huge impact here. And I really do consider the silent treatment to be one of the most normalized forms of emotional abuse. It is devastating. It is crushing. And you would not believe the number of times a client is working through the layers, and the deepest layer that puts them in a fetal position is a moment where their parents were giving them a silent treatment and icing them out.
Wow. That's big. What a revelation. I also have this desire to say to all of us who had parents, all of us who are parents, it's okay. We've all done some of these things.
Of course. But
that's why we're having this conversation. So if someone is listening and maybe for the first time is saying to themselves, oh my goodness, I was that good kid, a little bit like Mary Beth, what would you want them to understand about themselves that might kind of create that big seismic shift in how they view themselves, and but then also in how they parent their children.
Mm-hmm. So you probably have felt like you needed to be impressive. That's kind of the word that tends to stop clients in their tracks, in my experience. You know, you feel like you need to accomplish impressively. You feel like you need to carry that impressively. You feel like you need to be caring so much that anyone else would buckle, but you're crushing it without even breaking a sweat, right? And you might feel like the most lovable version of you is one who's impressive. Like, you have to earn that. But like, I really want to come in hard with this idea that maybe that was just what you were told. Like, maybe that's just how you were made to feel. Like, I know you've literally built an entire life around this impressive thing and making sure nobody ever sees a version of you that's not impressive. But really, we're trying to outrun this idea that there's something wrong with versions of you that are not impressive. And there's not. There's nothing wrong with who you are deep down. There may be things wrong with things that happened to you, ways people reacted to you, ways you reacted, but that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you. And maybe you don't need to chase your goodness and earn people's love by impressing them. Maybe you actually are good enough. Like, do you actually look at a child and think that the only version of them that's lovable and worthy is one that's impressive? Like, do you truly believe that? Why would it be different for you? Like, you're not the exception here. There's nothing wrong with you.
This is making me think a little bit about, there was an episode of This Is Us where one of the kids is always saying, God, why were you always so hard on me? Why were you always so nice to him? And the mom, in a moment of just frustrated conflict, is like, because he was easier. He was easier. And I was like, I was easier. There felt I needed to be easier. If good kids, as you mentioned in the book, look like they're crushing it at life, but they're not okay, if we only have appearances to gauge with, how can we tell how authentically well someone is doing? How do we get somebody to share what might be these anxieties that they themselves may not even recognize?
Mm-hmm. I mean, step one is, please, if you can, go to therapy. My book will guide you. And I really did write it with the end. I wrote my book so that even if you've never been to therapy, it will still make sense. Showing up with a willingness to look at yourself and examine things, right? Because as I say to adults, like, and I have a section in the book called, "But I Had a Great Childhood," because I hear that all the time. And I would have told you that too. And it's not that my childhood was terrible. There were happy moments, but there were a lot of parts of me that because things looked good on the outside, I would ignore or avoid the feelings on the inside that said things are actually not okay. And we owe it to ourselves to go back for the parts of us that weren't okay, that pretended like they were fine. And that's what this is about. It's not some like big, scary inner child retreat. It's just about going back for these parts of you that because they had to silence themselves, push their, you know, feelings down, put the smile on, right? Game face and a smile. It's so hard, I think, as a parent, because the parts of ourselves that feel the hardest to love will be the parts that are hardest to love within our kids, right? So I talk through in the book that I was made to feel really, really awful when I was needy. And so I wanted to be that mom who could just be like, "Come here, honey." Did not go that way. Rage, like rage out of nowhere, like blacked out came to, and I don't know what I said. Like I shut it down so hard because a part of me was like, "Nope, nope." And that part was like, "It's not safe to act like this with your mom."
Wow.
We must shut it down to protect her. The part was coming from such a loving place of trying to protect her, but based on the rules of my childhood. And so I really had to go back for the little needy little me and be like, was there anything wrong with her? Was she doing anything wrong? What did she deserve in that moment? And hold up and feel the pain of like, oh, she got that, but she deserved this. And then most of the time when I'm not stressed out, I'm able to be a soft spot to land when my kids, right, are needy. But we've got to like go back and do that. And that's really why in the parenting section, I mean, I talk through kind of the like how to see boundaries as a way that kids regulate. Like they, if we think like of a 1 to 10 of their stress level, 10 is where their body can't hold any more stress and it's going to force the release. This is where we lose it at 10 too, right? Sure. It's like a little thing and we get our sleeve caught and it's not really about the thing at 10. It's about all the little things, right? And so if we hit our kid at a 7 out of 10, they're going to be in the resistance. Like there's something that they've identified in the scientific literature, Gordon Newfield, called counterwill. It's literally like a resistance. I call it the resistance. But if we ask them the same question at a different point in time and they were at a 3, they could move through that without needing to push back. Like the pushback is purposeful and it tells us that they are dysregulated. And so we've got to see that differently. But the check engine lights, perfectionism, there's a difference between perfectionism and just trying to do things well, right? I'm concerned with the more insidious version of this. So I talk through it and what that looks like. People pleasing, like the over apologizing from a really scared place, assuming they're in trouble, worrying someone's mad or disappointed in them all the time. And like really being afraid to do what they need to do or what serves them because they're so afraid. I also talk through physical symptoms, like the tummy aches and the headaches and the, you know, muscle tension, picking at their skin, eating to soothe, like even when nothing seems wrong. But I think back to your point, like we do have to do the work on ourselves because I've had parents who try to say, "I'm safe. You can tell me how you really are." But then parts of them sometimes hijack and those parts need to shut stuff down. We've got to do the best we can and be committed to always circling back and breaking that cycle of sweeping stuff under the rug. I mess up all the time. Like I have more rage than I would have ever thought possible. I don't even think I was angry before I became a parent of a toddler. And the rage just came out of nowhere. But when you've been bottling your feelings, you have no strategy for how to manage anger because you've never really been angry before. Like, and then you have a toddler tantruming, like you're gonna have rage. So let's normalize that. But I have a 100% success rate of circling back to my kids and, "Hey, let's talk about what happened. You didn't deserve that. I snapped at you. That wasn't kind. Did I hurt your feelings? Did I scare you?" Like we apologize to each other. I apologize weekly, daily with my kids, right? So it's not about doing everything perfectly. We're gonna mess up. We're gonna fall into the old patterns of how our parents did stuff. Like Lynn was saying, like you're gonna move into the silent treatment and be like, "Oh no, ah." You come back and you say, "I am so sorry. I was so mad and a part of me just, and I just needed to ice you out. And that must've been really scary for you." I love saying it's safe to tell me how that feels. It's safe to tell me if that was scary for you. It's safe to tell me if that hurt you.
That's so good. If you have a kid in your life who apologizes all the time, you mentioned apologizing just now, that seems to me to be a big sign. Is there a very clear path to helping them realize a lot of times when it's not even anything that's their fault? How can we help them not feel they have to own everyone else's mistakes?
Yeah, I mean, I think I love to have the circle backs. I call it circle backs. It is about apologizing and repairing the rupture or in a relationship. But it's I really have circle backs anytime there's any kind of noticeable pattern with my kids. So three or four times of me losing it or them being snappy. Like I had one the other day with one of my kids. I'm like, you keep waking up so grumpy. And like, I get it. And you're tired, but like, you got to find a way to do that kindly. Cause I end up feeling kicked in the face. It's like, you can be grumpy, but like being mean and yelling at me for walk, like, I'm not doing that anymore. Just sitting down with them and saying, hey, I just want to talk through something that I'm noticing. Like I'm noticing you're apologizing a lot. And when kids are at a 7 out of 10, when they're dysregulated and unreasonable, that's not the moment. Like the kids can't hear you. Their nervous system's moving into fight flight. They're a balloon about to pop. It's later, right? So we don't try to move the needle when everybody's at a 10. That's not, we're not going to get anywhere. The magic is later when things have kind of calmed down and saying, this is the phrase that like, let's not misuse that phrase, but like, this is the phrase I found that kind of unlocks kids. How does it feel inside for you? So I've noticed that you seem to be apologizing a lot. And like, even when you haven't done anything wrong, and I'm just wondering, how does that feel inside for you? Is there a part of you, we love parts work in internal family systems, IFS. Is there a part of you that's worried that I'm mad? Is there a part of you that doesn't know where you stand with me? Those are the top two things like that I hear from parents and it happens between me and my kids too. Are you not sure where you stand with me? And so you're trying to get a pulse and make sure that we're good. Like assuming coming from this place of like, there's a reason you're doing this. There is a part of you that's over the over apologizing part that's gotten activated. And there's a reason. And like, I just want to understand how I can make you feel safe in our relationship and help you know that I'm not going anywhere and you don't have to do that. You know?
Yeah. Well, the book is Good Kids, Why You Suffered in Silence and How to Break the Cycle. And our guest is parenting expert and trauma therapist, Maggie Nick. Maggie, this is, wow, such great information, really opening my eyes up to a lot here.
Well, stay with us. We're going to continue our conversation with Maggie Nick, author of Good Kids, Why You Suffered in Silence and How to Break the Cycle, right after these messages.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
We've been speaking with trauma therapist and parenting expert Maggie Nick. We've been talking to her about her new book called Good Kids, Why You Suffered in Silence and How to Break the Cycle. Maggie, if our listeners didn't join us in the first half of the hour, let's give them a little recap of why you are more worried about good kids than about kids who may present those regular challenges throughout their whole life.
Yeah. A well-behaved child makes life easier as a parent. I'm in it. I get it. I love it. Love it when we have good behavior days, right? But a well-behaved child, like if I had to like give you two lists, a well-behaved child follows rules, keeps it together, doesn't disrupt. An emotionally healthy child, and what I'm kind of trying to help us all do, can mess up without hating themselves, right? An emotionally healthy child can be upset without assuming that everybody hates them or thinks they're dramatic and too much, right? An emotionally healthy child can disagree without bracing to lose that person, right? An emotionally healthy child can ask for help without feeling ashamed for needing the help. Like there's this insidious shame piece here, this thread. And that's really the biggest issue. It's really how we handle kids in their hard moments. Like that's the one place that if we can make a couple of adjustments there, it makes a huge difference.
Well, I've read a lot in recent months about oldest daughter syndrome, but boys experience this too. Do you see differences in how the good kid patterns manifest in girls versus boys, or even how society rewards or punishes each of them?
Yes. I talk about it a little bit in the book. you know, our parents raised the boys of our generation to be successful, basically, in work, and raised the girls in our generation to be moms, caretakers. So a man says no, and they call that competence. A woman says no, and they call her a bad word that starts with a B, right? You know, Taylor Swift has an amazing clip that I wish I could memorize, but it's like, if a man, you know, makes a business decision, they call it, you know, smart and intentional. If the woman does the same thing, they call it calculated, right? And manipulative. Yes, there are absolutely gendered nuances here around women being quiet and selfless and always taking care of other people. And the way that, like, if you're not being selfless, you're being selfish, and that's morally wrong and bad. And you better never let anybody see that side of you again.
Part of what I feel, I think the reason that some of these societal norms evolved is because they allow for a functional, orderly society, right? Everyone's got their jobs. There's a diffusion of labor and roles and things like that. But Gen Z is widely being seen as breaking down a lot of systems, which can be challenging for those who made or supported those systems for so long. Do you think society is ready to let go of this good kid ideal, or do we still need compliant children to maintain social order?
I'm not against well-behaved kids, first of all. Love kids when they can be well-behaved. I'm against shame as a tool for discipline, right? Shame is a tool for oppression, right? Shame oppresses. Making a child feel ashamed of themselves for misbehaving, for having a developmentally appropriate clock it. They're right at that developmental stage. They're pushing back and resisting boundaries exactly how a child their age is supposed to. And we are made to feel as parents, based on how we were parented, that we need to make them feel bad about themselves. And like, we've seen the real them, and the real them is bad. You know, we need to make space for children to be human without making them feel ashamed for having these moments. We got to check our expectations. That's one of my big shifts in the book. One of my five adjustments is checking our expectations. Like, expecting a child to never misbehave is wild. Like, that's insane. Like, we can do it. We can use shame, and shame will work, right? Air quotes. It'll work. We just got to, what do we want? We want a child who has no opinions, is terrified constantly that people are mad at them and that they're always going to lose people. Is that what we want? We can do it. It works, but they spend their lives recovering.
Maggie, I don't know how much you watched the recent Olympics, the Milano Cortina Olympics, but I did think about, you know, you see those struggles of the kids who grew up being the best. It made me look at that beautiful figure skater, that wonderful Ilya Malinin. You know, the pressure of being so good just got so big. You looked at the figure skater, Alyssa Liu, who kind of threw up her hands. She didn't want to be the good kid necessarily, or the good skater, or whatever it was. She just decided, forget this, I don't need this, and then came back to it and was so relaxed. And I ended up watching at the wrap-up of the Olympics a wonderful interview with Michaela Schifrin, and she really talked about and got to the essence of what it was. And I just think it's such a beautiful example. And I'm wondering what you think about how these kids arrive at where they are, a state of being comfortable in their skin with where they are.
Yeah, I'll have to go back and listen for that. That sounds like that's right up my alley. Yeah, I mean, I think I have worked with children who have gifts, right, of all kinds in my counseling practice. And when you have a child who's so gifted at a sport or, you know, instrument or whatever, like, it's hard not to want to follow that for them and take that as far as you can go. I do think they lose their childhood a little bit in it, right? And I think the things that I kind of look for kids, the things that are, and I have the 10 check engine lights for good kids in the book, which is I tried to pay attention for a couple months in my practice to like the top 10 things that I'm looking for. And like, perfectionism is so much more than like a healthy striving, right? To do things well. It steals your joy. You do something well, and then you can't even have the joy of it because you're already picking apart what you should have done better. That's hard. That's hard to watch, right? Like, you constantly apologizing for everything and feeling like you have to. When kids are like, it's fine. When they're obviously not fine. Kids need an adult, a grown up, that they can say, I'm not fine today. Actually, I'm not okay. So many parents are in the situation when they have high achieving kids in whatever, you know, way that's showing up, whether it's academically or with sports, where they kind of have to be like, well, pull yourself together. We're on in 5 minutes, you know? And I think that's hard to watch, you know? So it doesn't mean that they can't achieve amazing things, but there's a part of me that aches a little bit watching that. And I mean, obviously hearing the unfiltered truth of all of my clients and getting to work with some of those people and hear the reality of how they're actually doing inside. Like, I have a unique perspective here. Lots of shame and feeling really bad about yourself and anxiety can hide under gold medals and gold stars. You know, we've got to be checking in and making sure that their heart's still in it and that they're taking care of themselves. I think there can be space for like dedication and taking care of yourself, listening to your body. And I think about Simone Biles at where she got the twisties and had to pull out, and like everybody is just like, no, perform for us, perform, perform. It's like all everybody wants is just, you know, perform for me. Like, I think that's dangerous to make kids feel like they're the thing that gets them in the room, the thing that they have to negotiate their belonging in a space by performing and doing it perfectly with no mistakes. And if they, God forbid, they have a day where they're not on, everybody's like, are they retiring? What's going on? You know, like the cancel culture. I hope that answered your question.
No, I thought about that a lot. And I thought about you. I thought about Simone Biles as watching how the pressure elevate some people to their very highest performance ability, and depending on the day can crush you. If shame-based parenting was a fantastic evolution away from physical punishment, it's not perfect, but it was better perhaps than physical punishment. What do you think the next evolution of parenting paradigms is or should be? And what might we still get wrong with a new approach? It's there's always adaptations and nuances with it. So what do you think this next evolution could be?
I mean, I do really try to get curious and try to understand. Like you said, I do think we tried to move away from physical discipline, and that's really was, I mean, shame was always present, but as like the primary tool, I think shame, as we tried to stop hitting kids so much, shame kind of rose up, but we really did trade one poison for another, right? Like they're both poison, unfortunately. I think it is possible to raise children who are mostly well-behaved, but also human, like who are allowed to be a kid and look like what a kid looks like when they're dysregulated at 2, 4, 10, 15. Like, I think there needs to be space for them to be a kid and struggle the way kids struggle. I have a story in the book about the caterpillar's burden, because one of the things I have to say to myself sometimes is I was a caterpillar, but I think as a good kid, as a raging good kid, I was expected a lot of times to be like a mini adult. Right. And so it's almost like I was shamed for being a caterpillar with no wings. Right. I wasn't yet a butterfly, but I was made to feel like I should have been able to fly. So I tell a story in the book and just kind of walk you through a caterpillar who's like feeling so ashamed of themselves and feeling like they've let everybody down because they can't be a butterfly. And some of the times with my kids, I will realize that I'm putting kind of insane expectations on them. Right. And my therapist will clock it too. She'll be like, oh, we're asking a lot of a kid that age. I feel like we need to back up. And I'm like, really? Because that's what was expected of me. Right. But like when my kids are having these moments and they're maddening and they're hard and I don't enjoy them, but like when they're having these messy moments where they're needing to push back or they're needing to fall apart, those are not my favorite moments of parenting, but it is my kid being a caterpillar. And so it's like, it reminds me that this is a caterpillar moment. They're not yet a grown up. And like, we've got to keep reminding ourselves that they don't even, I mean, all the parts of the brain that come together to form self-control, impulse control, aren't even developed and fully working together until about 7. So you can't teach a child younger than that self-control unless you can accelerate their brain development, right? And so, you know, their brains are not fully developed until 25, which is wild. And so I think we've just got to keep reminding ourselves that like, this is what it was supposed to look like for us. We were expected to be, you know, have complete self-control unflinchingly. We were expected to be more emotionally regulated and mature than the grownups raising us. The expectations placed on us were insane a little bit. Yeah. And that doesn't mean that our parents did it on purpose. I think they were just parenting the way we were parented, right? Just like we all do. But we've got to check in here. Kids are going to be messy and loud and forgetful and emotional and impulsive. We do not need to make them feel like there is something fundamentally wrong with them for that. Mm-hmm. If our expectation is to never misbehave, we are literally setting them up to fail and then shaming them for failing.
Yeah, we have a friend who's who is an anthropologist and who lived in Africa for like 27 years. One time talking with her about a teenager that we knew, she asked how old he was, and she immediately dropped into anthropologist mode and was saying, oh, well, this is, he's clearly, you know, making some signs that he's separating from the tribe and he's pushing back against the norms. And it was such a fascinating moment because it allowed us to think of it so much less personally. Like, there are rhythms and chapters in our lives where you are meant to push back. You're meant to seek your own version of what you want the world to look like and to build that for yourself. And my husband and I heard this thing years ago about teenagers are on a roller coaster. Your job is not to ride it with them. Your job is to be the rails and to have this solid place for them to know is in place, which I think of with boundaries, I think of with calmness, whatever. But how can we tell when this is just a completely normal developmental stage or whether someone who is suddenly acting out, who's always been a good kid, you know, when are they just trying to even the scales and when are they possibly in trouble? And do we need to intervene in some way?
This is very an overgeneralization and an oversimplification, but in general, I'm way more concerned with the child who never acts out, truly. Yes, the acting out, if it's getting emotionally disturbed territory, right? Like self-harm, like there's certain, you know, like delighting and suffering. There are things that sort of raise red flags for me as a clinician, but there is research that shows that when children go through stress and trauma with access to a fight response, and fight response doesn't mean fighting, it just means doing something about it, right? Standing up, standing your ground, considering, have I been crossed here? Instead of just focusing on that person and are they mad? When children go through stress and trauma with access to outward fight, where you can stand up for yourself and do something on the outside, versus children who have fawn response, which is parent pleasing, people pleasing, good kid. There is no comparison to the way that impacts us psychologically and the fallout that comes when we can't do anything about it. We have to just freeze and play dead. We have to appease and talk down the threat and beg them to not hurt us. Like, that's basically what we're talking about. And so good kids have access to fight response, but they turn it inward. That's why they don't need to be parented, because they're vicious with themselves, right? They get that gold medal and they're already like, oh, well, you messed up here and here and here and here and here. And that better never happen again, you know?
We're speaking with trauma therapist and parenting expert Maggie Nick. Her new book is called Good Kids, Why You Suffered in Silence and How to Break the Cycle. We were talking earlier about, you know, beginning with physical discipline and then we evolved into shame-based parenting. I don't think most parents think of it in those terms, like I'm going to shame my child. I do remember this was 3 decades ago. I was pregnant with my first son, so I was very tuned in to parents around me, and I was at a restaurant, and the table next to me, I could hear there was a dad with his 2 little girls, and he kept saying things to the 1 little girl, like, let's see if you can make it through this entire dinner without spilling your drink. I was flabbergasted. Okay, so that dad was using shame. He didn't know he was using shame as a strategy for parenting. So how do we recognize when we're doing that as parents? And what could he have said to turn that whole situation around?
Yeah, I mean, there's a zoom out here. Okay, so, and I hear this all the time. That's what's kind of, I'm giggling because parents, the whole time I've had my Instagram account, I've been sharing information. I'll have parents be like, your information and your work is so fascinating, but I don't shame my kids. And I'm like, ooh, I live and breathe this. My brain never stops thinking about it. And I shame my kids sometimes. So we all shame our kids. But it's not like we're thinking, I'm going to make my kid suffer right now. It just comes out, right? Especially moments of stress. when my stress is at a 7 out of 10, 10 being the place where body's like, we're going to blow, right? Either I'm crying or I'm screaming. When I get about 70%, my body's like, all right, well, I'm gonna put you in the situation room and I've got these parts of me. They're going to come and take over. And that's when we find ourselves saying the things that we said we would never say, right? Has to do with not managing our stress, and we're bottling. And then we get to a point. So good kid trauma, the type of trauma that I'm trying to flag in clinical terms, is called relational shame trauma. And it's being repeatedly made to feel like who you are deep down inside is something to be ashamed of. Okay. So when our emotions get the best of us, or we make a big mistake, we mess up, we spill, and our parents respond with, "What is wrong with you?" We're like, "I don't know. I know I'm not supposed to do that. And yet I did it. So yeah, you're right. There must be something wrong with me." Right. We say things when our parents said things to us, like, "Why can't you just pull yourself together? You're just being so dramatic. You should know better," right? "I'm not mad. I'm just disappointed." As kids, we didn't just learn, don't do that. The core belief that we internalized, because shame is that powerful, like our body pays really close attention to the moments where we're made to feel ashamed. There are reasons for this that go back to survival, right? When we lived in tribal communities, needing community and being ostracized from the group was literally threatening to our survival. And our nervous system pays really close attention to shame and clocks it and remembers it, right? And when we're set, when our parents said all these, those things to us, it was like, okay, cool. There's something wrong with me because I did that. And there's something wrong with a version of me that acts that way. It's like being seen in a bad way, right? Like, this is who you really are. Like, you remember we would have lazy moments, or we'd have moments where we were tired, but we weren't allowed to be tired somehow ever. And so our parents would come in with this like, "Oh, you're just being lazy." And we had this feeling of, they've seen the real me. This is who I really am. And the energy that came from our parents was like, this version of you is unacceptable, and I better never see it again. We spend our lives trying to make sure that nobody finds out. The first piece I wrote for the book with this idea of nobody finds out, I didn't know if it would land. And when my editor read it, she was like, "Oh, it lands." Because that's how it feels for me. Like, that there's this like, don't let anybody ever find out. Don't let them find out that you're not as perfect. Don't let them find out that you struggle. Like, you're supposed to struggle but nobody can see it, right? And it gives us these really crushing core beliefs that drive our whole personality to be people-pleasing, to be that perfectionist, to be the shape-shifting chameleon, to literally shape-shift into whatever version of ourselves would be the most acceptable, most lovable for this person. So I think it's more checking our expectations. Is it realistic to think that a toddler could go through a meal and not spill? I mean, it's possible. Is that like a fair expectation though? No, that's ridiculous. We're going to be like, "Oh no, we spilled," and make a game out of it. I guess we could do that. But like, to make the child feel like there's something wrong with them, you have this expectation and they have to meet it or else you're disappointed. What?
Not to belabor that topic about the spilled milk, but we all spill our drinks from time to time. So instead, how about, "Oh gosh, I've spilled my milk before. Here's what I try to do. I try to set it out of the way," or something. I don't know. Because that's really a metaphor for everything, right? We're all tired sometimes. We're all cranky sometimes. We're all angry sometimes. We all cannot handle the day sometimes.
100%. So, well, and my ability to be that calm, loving parent who's like, "No problem, you spilled, it happens to everybody," has everything to do with where my stress level is, right? If I'm bottling and pushing everything down, eventually my body can't hold it anymore. And again, 7 out of 10 tends to be our dysregulation zone. And that's where I'm going to snap. I'm going to be less Mary Poppins and more like vicious Batman. And so we're going to have these moments where we, you know, all of us, our only strategy with feelings our whole life, for the most part, has been push them down and hope for the best. So there are going to be moments where it explodes out of us and we are snappy and we, right? And it's going to happen. It happens to me, but I have a 100% success rate with circling back and going, "Hey, that wasn't that big of a deal. I didn't have the space and I made you feel bad." Like, that, it's okay for you to spill. And in that moment, I just was a little too stressed out to be calm and kind, right? It doesn't mean you can never lose it on your kid for spilling. Like, God, right? It's like parenting is so hard. We just, when we do, you know, breaking cycles and being a generational cycle breaker is not about doing this perfectly. We're going to mess up all the time. I mess up all the time. God, and I wish more parenting experts would admit that, like, openly. That's part of being a normal human. I'm still learning how to regulate my stress, you know? We've just got to circle back.
I can't imagine the stress of being a parenting expert, because I think we all know, like, psychologists or who have kind of messed up seeming offspring that, and they should know all the perfect ways, but sometimes people are just who they are. It's their path. What would you say to the parent who might recognize themselves in this book and feel guilty and want to make a change, whether their kids are grown or still young and in development? What can we do if we're a parent that feels like, oh crap, I think I might have done some of these things?
Again, I wrote the book and I make the very mistakes. Like, I think we've got to stop expecting perfection. That is leftover, right? Unattainable expectations that are actually impossible. So it's okay. I mess up all the time. Just circle back with your kid. Obviously, we need to try not to hurt our kids with our rage. That's one thing I say to myself when I can feel rage bubbling, is like, we are committed to not hurting our kids with this rage. You need to do something. You need to step away. You need, right? And it's about me taking myself by the hand and saying, let's go to the other room. Let's release this rage into a pillow. Let's regulate and come back. Of course, you're falling into these patterns. There is no other way this could have gone. And a lot of your healing and the extent that you've healed is going to be reflected in your parenting. In other words, I really wanted to be soft spot to land for my daughter when she was needy, maybe more than anything else in the world. I didn't clock it that was probably a reflection of how much shame I was carrying for being needy sometimes, right? And then I tell this story in the book. There were a couple times when she was two that she would get needy and I would almost like black out and come back. And I had like snapped at her, right? Because the parts of her that feel the hardest to love are the parts of me that I feel like are hardest to love, that it generally are the ones that are carrying the most shame. And so in order to be able to be a soft spot for her, I had to go back and heal that. Like, why do I feel so much shame for being needy? Oh, it's probably because that's how I was treated when I was needy. We're constantly going through this and we need to pay attention to the things that trigger us and set us off when we kind of have this instant reaction that doesn't line up. And then we need to go back for that and be like, what was that? It's probably shame. Just a spoiler alert. It's almost always shame. So
when we're able to dig a little deeper into our own patterns, we're able to see how they might be affecting that. We've been talking with Maggie Nick, whose new book, Good Kids, Why You Suffered in Silence and How to Break the Cycle, is out. So if you're interested in this topic, and if you're not, maybe it's even more important experiencing more of this than you realize. Please, please check it out. Thank you, Maggie Nick, for being with us.
You girls are wonderful. Thank you.